This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com.
From time immemorial, beginning with indigenous councils and ancient wisdom traditions, through the work of Western visionaries such as Plato, Galileo, and quantum physicist David Bohm, mutually participatory dialogue has been seen as the key to evolving and transforming consciousness, evoking a flow of meaning, a Daya flow of logos, meaning, beyond what any one individual can bring through alone. So join us now, as together with you, the active deep listener, we evoke and engage in living dialogues. Welcome to Living Dialogues. I'm your host, Duncan Campbell, and with me for this particular dialogue, I'm really deeply delighted to have John O'Donohue, author most recently of a very beautiful book entitled Eternal Echoes, Exploring Our Yearning to Belong. Prior to that, many of you may know him as the author of Anamkara, translated as Soul Friend from the Celtic. Anamkara remains number one on the bestseller list in Ireland after its appearance over 2.5 years ago and has been on numerous bestseller lists here in America. John, it's a really deep pleasure to see you again after 2 years.
It's lovely to be here with you, Duncan. We had threatened this a long time ago, but hadn't got round to doing it.
That's right, and we even tried to do it the first time, and the machinery did not cooperate, which means we weren't quite ready for each other at that point.
Hopefully we're ready now.
Yeah, I feel very much so. Reading your most recent book, Eternal Echoes, I tell you, it was like balm for the soul, B-A-L-M. It was just absolutely wonderful. I think it's one of the most beautiful poetic prose books I've ever read. And I'd like to just jump right into what it was like for you to create this book before we talk about the substance of it. In our discussions, you indicated that it really took a lot out of you.
It took an awful lot out of me, I suppose, because I wrote the book in about 5 months flat. And that was day and night writing. And I had been working with these constellation of ideas for a good while in my mind. And to get them ordered and sequenced in a way that I wanted was very difficult. And secondly, I think it goes deeper than the Anamkara Book of Celtic Wisdom book does. I tried to create, like I did in Anamkara, a text with a dual kind of texture. On the surface, if you like, a lyrical texture, which is poetic, has narrative and works a lot with image. And then underneath that, a more speculative text, which calls one back, hopefully, for further reflection. I mean, I've been amazed that people have said to me that they have read and reread it again and again, which is nice because the book is not intended to really be about itself or about me or anything. The book is intended in a way, in an artistic sense, to be an object through which one can engage one's own kind of latent complexity and divinity. And it's intended in a way to be an invitation to oneself over certain thresholds, maybe that one has kept away from, and which I would argue that there's no need to be afraid of at all, that there's great potential there.
Well, beautifully stated, John, because it reminds one of books like, I don't know, Pascal's Pensée or Marcus Aurelius's Meditations or the Book of Common Prayer, books that are not meant to be read from start to finish and then it's over, but actually to do exactly what you say, to catch you with that shimmering poetic beauty on the surface, but to go underneath that and to invite you to look into your own depths, which you can do and revisit again and again. As you say, it's a journey, almost a journey without end.
Yeah, I think it is. And I think that there are certain books that become companions for us, you know. Mm-hmm. And I suppose one of the things that I love most in the world is the presence of thought. I love thoughts and thinking. And I suppose that's what I'd just be doing most of the time, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm always excited about new ideas. And I loved my time in Germany for that reason, the 4 years I spent working on the old PhD on Hegel's phenomenology, because it was a time of the most intense and critical and speculative kind of thinking. And I suppose in postmodern culture and in a lot of alternative spirituality, I miss a depth of thought. I miss a substance, and I miss thoughts that have enough clay and darkness around them to recall you and bring you back again and again. I think that our times and our postmodern culture suffers from a very dead transparency, where there is a light lava of cliché over every surface and every depth. And we manage to keep skating on this thing and pretending that we're somehow engaging our lives, and we're not at all. I think that, particularly here in this country, that I've been amazed at the way people speak about themselves, that they speak about themselves in terms of function, in terms of program, in terms of syndrome, in terms of woundedness, and that identity becomes reduced to that awful, superficial kind of cliche, when in actual fact the given stories that they narrate about themselves are not the real stories at all. I mean, the real stories are far more vigorous and interesting and complex and subversive kind of thing. So what I think is that we need to pay attention to the words we use about ourselves. And I think that the who question is one of the most exciting questions of all. And it's almost like, you know, when you throw a pebble in a pond, the way the ripples go out and they become ever wider. And I think that's the way the who question does. It starts with a certain fixed frame, who are you? And then goes out and out and out to embrace more and more of you. And I'd like to imagine that these two books, the Anamkara book and the Eternal Echoes book, in some way might assist a few people to get excited about the adventure of who they are. Always when I'm launching a book for friends, the last thing I often say, launching a poetry book or a novel or whatever, is may this book find its way to those who really need it. And I hope that these do too.
Well, I think in the nature of things that ultimately, if not in the proximate sense, it will. And it's going to be egged on, in my view, and encouraged by precisely what you state. In fact, your beautiful phrase here, a light lava layer of cliché, I might even reformulate as a light ash layer of cliché. I don't know if it's even really substantial enough to be called lava.
I think ash is more precise.
Yeah, it can actually just blow away.
That's right.
And it's very interesting that in the New Age movement, when we, I think, understand that there is depth to the traditional and ancient wisdom that the real mystic experience is beyond thought, there is some sense that just by saying it, you can make it so. And actually not appreciating the leverage element of thought, of that deep thought. Like in your book, you mention in a bibliography for people to explore further at the end, St. John of the Cross. Deep, dark thoughts, thoughts that are profoundly provocative that people sometimes go to only in the depth of their own despair when they are willing to encounter the uncomfortable and painful quality of it because they're driven to it by a sense of no other alternative, that the light surface no longer satisfies and they feel compelled to go deeper.
But I think it's a great consolation, though, to know that when these bleak times actually surface in one's life and one is called to walk with bare feet on very stony and very scarred ground, that it's great to know that in our tradition that there are documents like John of the Cross, like Meister Eckhart, like Teresa of Avila, like Julian of Norwich, that you can go to, and that they become, like in the old Irish tradition, you know, when we fought against England for so long, people who'd be on the run, we'll say, that there'd be a possibility of a safe house for them. Mm-hmm. And I think that often when you're on the run with an old cargo of pain yourself, that it's great to know that in our tradition there are safe houses like Eckhart and Teresa and John of the Cross, where you can actually come in and where you're met in the full intensity of what you're actually enduring, and where the language has enough nuance and enough flexibility in it to actually engage the full depth of what you're enduring. I think at that point that you really feel embraced and you feel understood, and I think everybody needs that. I think that that happens naturally all the time in friendship and in partnerships between people that have not compromised and are still willing to grow. and that people actually come down below their own image into a depth with each other, where a lot of stuff can be left alone and doesn't have to be reworked every minute, but where big thresholds can be crossed together. And maybe no one else outside the relationship or friendship would know that both of you are crossing them, but you actually would. And I think that growth, like, I think there's a lot to be said for an old poetics of growth. And I said, I think that you're absolutely right, that almost in spite of ourselves, that the psyche forces us and invites us to become who we are. And I think that the only way into our destiny is to try to awaken and engage our potential. And you know, I often think we were taught in the Christian tradition so much about sin and negativity and all the rest of it. And we were never told that the greatest sin was the unlived life. And if we don't engage who we are and try to become who we are, then we will never be content or happy. And we will always be out of rhythm with ourselves if we settle for the frontiers that others appoint for us.
And that brings up the whole question of course, institutional religion or belief systems that have been the shelters that people have looked to historically. And as you point out, in our modern or postmodern era, many of these traditional shelters are in ruins. They no longer evoke that sense of belonging. People are actually not going to traditional churches. They are actually also not staying in traditional marriages, because somehow there's been a disconnect in those forms as lived by those who feel that they're not bringing themselves into connection with what it is that they deeply yearn for. And the way you express this in your book is you talk about the connection between longing and belonging. And you point out that, let us take a marriage relationship where the two parties are not going below their surface personalities with one another. They're not living the deep life of truth and courage and integrity that you speak about. The corollary of that is that the longing disappears and it becomes a marriage of convenience, let us say.
It becomes a dead arrangement.
And when the longing is gone and it becomes a dead arrangement, then neither party feels any real deep sense of belonging.
Yeah, that's what I often feel, you know, that phrase in the marriage ceremony, till death do us part. That very often that kind of psychological numbing is a death that does part them, because there is no longer a bridge across the vacancy from one self to the other self. I think, though, that we're in the midst of a huge crisis of belonging in postmodern culture. Like I try to argue in the prologue of the book and throughout the book, indeed, the institutions of Western religion are great traditions. And I have immense respect for a great tradition, because I think a great tradition houses huge wisdom, and it's where the unknown is looked after in some way. And what disappoints me, I suppose, is that very often the stewardship of these great traditions has fallen into the hands of frightened functionaries who are incredibly adept politicos and great masters of the doorways. They know what membership is, whether you have a right to be in or not, or if you're inside and misbehaving, how you should exit and not get in again. But they know little of the further landscapes behind the gateway where the treasure is hidden, and the wells and the mountains and the secret glades. They know nothing of these things. They are not touched by the vision or haunted by the quest for the mystical. And sometimes hungry people in postmodern culture, and there's an acute spiritual hunger in our times, past the gateways, these granaries where the grain is stored, and they never are given to believe for 1 minute that the grain is stored there. So I think one of the ways of characterizing this is the postmodern culture is kind of arrested, and that there are hugely vital conversations that are just not taking place, and that that's one of them, between the custodians of the Christian tradition and those who are seeking nakedly and desperately. Another conversation that's not taking place, and the absence of this event really frightens and troubles me deeply, because I think it's going to have amazingly destructive repercussions for us if we don't begin it. And that's a conversation that's not taking place between Christianity and Islam. I think that Edward Said and Hanna Ashrafi, some of these people, have made great efforts to do that. But like when we think of Islam, we think Islam fundamentalists. When they think of us, they think Western capitalists. And I think that there could be an immensely exciting conversation there between the beautiful symbolic mysticism and depth of theology in the Islamic tradition and culture and our own kind of culture. I also think there's a crisis of belonging in politics that has now become synonymous with economics and with the crudest forms of strategy and one-upmanship and pragmatism.
Vulgarism,
yeah. And I think that this leaves us, you know, leaves us in a very flat landscape with no mountains in sight and a total distrust of ideals, because those who are supposed to be presenting the ideals have either betrayed them through their pragmatism, and I'm not talking about morality here, or else those who present the ideals are right-wing fundamentalists who seem singularly unburdened by any sense of complexity or uncertainty, and who present a cold infinite which is callous and naively nostalgic and very dangerous and destructive. And that what's missing is someone who can call us, invite us to ideals that call our deepest potential alive, confront the negativity and the selfishness of our egoism, and somehow addresses what is gracious and elegant within us, so that we can inhabit the planet together in a way that is creative and good, you know?
Absolutely. Beautifully stated. Once again, I remember in my own life, when I was 6 years old, my first conscious memory is one of a mystical awareness of the wonder of all that is and all that was. And I felt a calling myself to connect with that, to explore that as deeply as I could, and to share my experience with others in a sense of community. And as you might put it in your book, a sense of belonging. And having been born into a family where I was raised in the Catholic Church, I was led to believe that perhaps becoming a priest was the way to experience and share that particular mystical calling. And I remember a great crisis in my early teens when I came to the shocking realization that the Christian brothers who were teaching me were actually only bureaucrats, that they didn't have any sense at all of this vaster vision, and they were, exactly as you say, frightened functionaries, good-hearted, well-intentioned, but walking right past the granary every time. It's really remarkable to hear you say this, because in a sense, it's my life story, and I think a kind of every man's story, where at some point I went through a crisis and became an agnostic, which I thought was the only honest thing to do, and then eventually an atheist. I studied Western philosophy as you did. I studied Hegel. I wrote papers on Hegel. I wrote my thesis on Jean-Paul Sartre as the intellectual in politics, because I thought that perhaps politics was a way out of the existentialist weak low or dead end of Western philosophy. It had taken thought as far as it could go, and perhaps if we could move into action in the political sphere, these were the days of civil rights, the days of the anti-Vietnam War protests, and we thought we could change the world, and that has in turn come to a dead end. And as you say, all of these conversations that, as Eric Erickson in his beautiful book, Youth, Identity, and Crisis, indicates should be happening ideally in society between youth, young people between 18 and 30, holding up society's ideals to it as a mirror with their youthful idealism, having an ethical dialogue, he calls it, with elders who they respect and who respect them most importantly, and they leaven the idealism with a kind of practicality and are rejuvenated in the discussion as the young ones are maturing in the discussion. None of that is happening.
That's
none
right.
of these
that's
conversations
very well,
are happening.
That's very, very well articulated and described. They aren't, you see. And actually, if you come down a bit further below 18 into the whole adolescent terrain, when people are supposed to be subversive, if not for visionary reasons, at least because of the hormone turbulence that should be going on inside the flesh. And you look at them and they are kind of anarchic and all the rest of it, seemingly. But yet you look at them and they're all in uniform, designer uniform. It's just unbelievable, you know.
Yeah.
And I think another big imbalance is that that young people and even children are now the targets of consumerist aggression and are constantly visited by kind of possibilities of having this kind of designer thing, that kind of thing, and so that they're all fit into this one boring kind of club. And I often wonder, you know, I think that childhood is an immensely rich forest of first acquaintances with everything. And I think that in subsequent life, that the forest of childhood anchors you as you stretch further out into your own life. And I just wonder about the cultural consequences of that shrinkage, of shrinking the innocence and lyricism of childhood back and back and back and back, so that children at an incredibly early age now are totally with it, like, and that the residue of innocence is very, very limited. And I just wonder about that. In the book, I have a whole thing about innocence and arriving in the planet and that, and innocence and wonder, and how innocence allows us to meet mystery without letting mystery destroy us, you know. And I just wonder about the consequences of that devastation.
And, oh, it's again so well stated, John, because we look across our cultural landscape, not only in America, but also in Ireland, in India, in South America, in Asia. Our global landscape has now become littered with the lifeless souls, the dead souls of Gogol's great phrase, of people who have become products themselves, who have been turned into targets for producers, targets of consumerism. And I recall right here in Boulder, where we're having this conversation, walking into the Wild Oats Market just last week and being really quite shocked, but not surprised, to see one of the little baby carts that they have. They have mini shopping carts that are quite low to the ground, and they're meant for the shopper to carry their young child in it while they're doing their shopping. And on top of this, there was a little flag that said, customer in training.
That shows exactly.
And there it is, right in the heart of politically correct Boulder, Colorado, in the politically correct organic shopping mall of Wild Oats. And, mm-hmm. and there it was. And we had a man come through Boulder not long ago who specializes in child's education, who told us of a young girl, 9 years old, in the Midwest, who answered his question as part of his tour, what would you like to be when you grow up? And her answer was, a consumer.
My goodness. Yeah.
And so we really are in mm-hmm. that mode. And Harvey Cox, in March of 1999, wrote a brilliant article for the Atlantic Monthly about the market, with a capital M, as the new religion. Mm-hmm. Many people mm-hmm. don't recognize it, but the whole sense of the commodification of human experience, mm-hmm. the end of innocence, the taking 5 and 6 year olds and making them models in Vogue magazine, mm-hmm. Talk about the end of innocence and the exploitation of the human body itself as a product. And it reminds me then of Sulak Sivaraksha, the great Buddhist leader and civic activist on an international scale, has formed a coalition of Muslim, Christian, and Judaic faiths against consumerism. An international convocation against consumerism, which he described in one of these dialogues to me as the new satanic religion. And it, because it's satanic, because it disempowers people. Instead mm-hmm. of awakening them to the mystery, it actually closes them down. It makes them more alienated. It makes them feel acutely the hole in their soul. But instead of that yearning being directed toward what you call the sense of the great belonging, the all-embracing divinity that is ever-present, it gets directed toward the Gap market or to the local
exactly.
supermarket,
exactly.
and it keeps our society functioning, but it never, ever gets satisfied.
Yeah, to come back to a person that you worked on and mentioned there a while ago, Jean-Paul Sartre, he said beautifully someplace in his writings, there is a God-shaped hole in my soul. And I think that that's it exactly. I think that there is a point in each of us that is incommensurable, that nothing really and no one can engage us there or close up that opening, and that's an opening towards the divine. I think in our times, and I've done a whole thing in this book now, which I didn't do in the last one, on consumerism and functionalism in contemporary society, because I think our society, rather than following the luminous path of the who question reduces everything to the mechanics of the how question, even in relation to the psyche. Mm-hmm. You look at the, you listen to the language that people use in this country, the land of the free and the home of the brave, about the complexity of themselves, and it's all the most vulgar and trite little functionalist kind of cliches, instead of the gracious elegance of the unknown within themselves and witnessing that great kind of event of soul that's always happening. And I think that the new God is quantity, and it's a cold kind of infinite, and you see it in the whole computer thing. So I think that we live, I was down in Atlanta in Georgia the other day. I spent a great day in Atlanta. I met actually two Southern Belles as well, but I had a great time. And the woman that was bringing me around showed me a certain weed, she had a name for it, that grows down there. And it grows a foot in a day. And if it's not trimmed back, like it can cover everything. And it struck me as a very precise image for the consumerist cluster that's happening around and blocking out all light.
Like a cancer.
That's it, exactly. And I think that I think we need, what can the individual do? Like, are we powerless and helpless in this? I don't think we are. I think we have great kind of potential because of the subversive anarchic nature of human consciousness. And I think one of the first steps is to become aware of what's happening. And the second step, I think, in each life is to have some little praxis whereby you make some clearances for yourself in that. And you can do that with some stillness by building in a rhythm of stillness, silence and solitude into your life. And I also think that poetry is wonderful in this regard. And there's a poet out in the, he died in 1993, who lived in Oregon and was born in Kansas and had a great influence on the great Robert Bly and on the wonderful Palestinian-American poet Naomi Shihab Nye, and his name was Bill Stafford. And in the latest book from his estate, which is a wonderful book that I'd recommend to anybody that's writing, called Crossing Unmarked Snow, he has the following four sentences that you could use them as an examination of conscience for yourself, or as four great sentences to make clearances or to live your life around. First sentence is, the things you do not have to say make you rich. Saying the things you do not have to say weakens your talk. Hearing the things you do not need to hear dulls your hearing. The things you know before you hear them, this is you, and this is the reason that you're in the world. I think you have there, elegantly expressed by Bill Stafford, a majestic invitation to your own eternity and to your own hidden divinity, which, in order to come back to religion again, it has always surprised me, you know, that Western Christianity has managed to suppress our recognition of our own divinity and has concentrated instead a lot on guilt and fear and all the rest of it. And I think maybe now is the time for us to invite the divine side of our souls to come alive. Meister Eckhart said beautifully that there's a place in the soul that neither time nor flesh nor anything external can ever touch. And that means that there's a place in you where you are completely in one rhythm with the eternal and with the divine. I think the intentionality of love, partnership, friendship, prayer, creativity and silence is as often, as frequently as you can, to visit that place and to rest there for renewal.
Well, that's, again, very beautifully stated, and I think the emphasis on praxis here as we're coming to the close of this particular dialogue is very well stated, because Michael Lerner, as you know, in the Jewish tradition...
Oh, I met Michael, actually, at the State of the World Forum. We had a great blast. He's a great man.
Yeah, one of the participants, along with Rabbi Zalman Schachter, who is very much his senior by one or two generations, but nonetheless, both have collaborated in the inauguration of the Jewish Renewal Movement, and Michael's magazine called Tikkun.
Tikkun, I'm supposed to write something for him for that.
To renew and rehabilitate the world. And he speaks also of how our conversations with one another have gone dead as we have learned subliminally to treat one another as commodities. And so if you're no longer functional or serviceable in a short-term kind of vision, then you get rid of the partner and you go looking for a newer or different, shinier model.
That's right.
And so at the end of the day, what it really comes down to is how can we extricate ourselves from this constant, subliminal, extraordinarily professional bombardment of the advertisers and the consumer producers who are skillful beyond measure in terms of reaching deep into our unconscious.
That's
and
right.
I think in the last minute here, perhaps you could just comment on that. And
I agree with you completely. I think that it's almost the consumerist drive is almost like a massive destructive spider spinning a huge web which entangles us all. And I think the person to turn for guidance in this way is a secular priest of these regions called Franz Kafka,
mm-hmm.
who in his work describes with great vigor and edge the relentless logic of this kind of absurdity, where after a while people forget that it's absurd and deplete their energies and drive themselves crazy trying to follow its driven demonic rhythm.
A metamorphosis of the worst kind.
Exactly, and metamorphosis is the story.
Yeah, right. Well, John O'Donohue, again, just a tremendous pleasure to spend this time with you, and we recommend to our readers your new book, Eternal Echoes, Exploring Our Yearning to Belong, and to listen in again to our next Dialogues program, because we will continue this conversation with John and also visit a little bit his prior book, Anamkara. Be with us again next time on Living Dialogues. I'm your host, Duncan Campbell. John O'Donohue, once again, a great pleasure.
Thank you very much, Duncan.
And visit us on my website, livingdialogues.com. That's living, DIALOGUES.com. And if you'd like to listen freely to additional archived visionary dialogues with myself and other transformational thinkers listed on my livingdialogues.com website, once you have entered your free subscription to the Living Dialogues podcast here on Personal Life Media, future Living Dialogues will automatically be downloaded to your computer on a weekly basis. Or simply browse through the list of programs here whenever you like, download them, or listen to them on your computer. Thanks again for your deep listening in evoking this program. All the very best. And stay tuned now after the music for some very interesting opportunities available to you as a listener to Living Dialogues.
Find more great shows like this on PersonalLifeMedia.com.